You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
As long as the weaker allies didn't come up to certain minimal standards. We've managed, I think, to solve a lot of these disparities, for example, through looking at critical dependencies, getting allies to identify their networks on which NATO depends for its missions, and to ensure that once we recognise what those networks are, they come to the same level as cybersecurity as allied networks. We've signed memoranda of understanding between NATO and individual allies for crisis response, including the well-known dispatch of the rapid response teams, if need be. And we've made cyber a planning domain in the NATO defence planning process, which means that now all allies accept capability targets in the cyber area in the same way that they accept capability targets to improve airfields or to modernise their aircraft or whatever. And that means, of course, that that system then becomes transparent. Allies have to explain why they are not meeting those targets, and we can identify where the gaps and vulnerabilities are. We've greatly stepped up the sharing of intelligence on cyber threats and incidents, both before and after, in terms of lessons learned, by creating a CTAC, or Cyber Threat Assessment Centre, and we've launched a number of smart defence projects, which involve groups of allies to develop capabilities which are then available to all, like malware sharing platforms or cyber capability for early detection and incident handling, and education and training. The education and training part is key because, as you know, in the cyber area, the technology is important. But as France learned in 1940 when it was at war with Nazi Germany, having a tank which is as good as the German tank doesn't get you very far if you don't have the organisation, the tactics, the people and the processes sorted out, where, of course, Guderian was superior to all. And so equally in the cyber area, we need to make sure that the skills of our operators are on par, and therefore, as you know, we organise every year a number of exercises such as Lock Shields or Cyber Coalition. That said, having started with the Allies, of course, we recognise that in the cyber domain, the partnership with industry is the key. It's an obvious fact that all of you here know that industry owns 85% of the networks. Industry innovates in the cyber area. We, of course, use their products, and we need to persuade industry to think security in the design of a product rather than as an afterthought once the product has been launched on the market and the zero-day vulnerabilities have been discovered. We also know from various incidents at NATO where we've had to handle in the middle of the night or in the weekend denial of service attacks, that the way to make these go away is to call out industry, frankly, in terms of giving you the bandwidth, the filters that you need to be able to manage these. So we've actually experienced firsthand just how critical this is. What we're trying to do now at NATO, very briefly, it is to sort of replicate at the multinational level the same kind of information sharing, incident management, supply chain management relationships that the United States, that the UK, France and other allies have developed at the national level, the kind of trusted networks. And this has been given a name at NATO. It's called the NCIP, the NATO NATO Industry Cyber Partnership. We launched it a year ago at the NATO Information Assurance Symposium down at Mons. And what we are trying to do is to put the flesh on the bones. There are three aspects to this. First of all, a portal, a secure portal, whereby we can hopefully go to an interactive sharing of confidential information with industry. The malware sharing platform can be helpful here because it breaks the data down into packets, which could be distributed broadly, but which also does not reveal, either on the intel side or the industry side, the characteristics that could be compromising for industrial industrial secrets or for intelligence secrets. Secondly, an incubator, because what we want to do is to be able to test the most innovative new things coming onto the market. And what we're going to do in the future is that we have in Estonia a cyber range, which you're familiar with, which we're upgrading to NATO standards for exercises, but we're going to sort of simulate the NATO networks as a kind of model of NATO on the cyber range, so that the incubator hub, which will be based with the NATO Communications and Information Agency, will then be able to sort of take good ideas from the private sector, from big companies or small companies, and immediately put them up on the cyber range to see, do they work? Does this product do what it says it could do? Because in the cyber area, although we spend $100 billion+ a year now on cyber security worldwide, there's still at the organization, the company level, a certain degree sometimes of uncertainty about, am I really buying the right product for me? Like we all obsess about our investments and our insurance policies. Do I really have what I particularly need? So an incubator hub. And finally, a cyber innovation fund, which is modelled on our Defence Against Terrorism programme of work, where we can use some seed money, particularly to help the small and medium-sized enterprises to approach NATO and to be able to come forward and demonstrate their products and help industry in the early stages to develop a promising new idea. So those are our three main so-called business cases which we're developing to make the NATO cyber industry partnership work. A lot, of course, is going to depend on the quality of our relationship with the EU, and currently we are developing within NATO a memorandum of understanding for how the NATO NSERC, our computer response capability, in the future could exchange information with the EU CERT as well. Of course, the EU would have to approve that, and the EU has a voice in this, but hopefully that will see the light today. So to paraphrase Winston Churchill, who used to say, you remember, that it's not the end, it's not even the beginning of the end, but at least it's the end of the beginning. I think, you know, in NATO, also in trying to form the right partnerships to be effective in the cyber world, we've still got a lot to do. But at least the appetite for the Allies for moving beyond the minimal protection of our own networks to a much larger cybersecurity community, that appetite is increasing, as it has to, given the evolving nature of the cyber threat. I probably took more than 5 minutes, so I apologise for that, but at least hopefully that gives you a sense of what we're up to. Thank you, Giles.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Not much more. We'll come back to the proof of the pudding when we open up for questions. Let's turn now to Lindert von Bockhoven from IBM. Lindert, can I ask you, there's a lot of emphasis on public-private partnerships. What does that mean when looked at from an IBM point of view?
Good. Well, let me come back to that during one of my introductory comments here. Thank you very much. Great pleasure for me to be here today. A couple of years ago, I was in Stockholm visiting a castle called Vaxholm. It was built in 1544 by Gustav I from Sweden. That was strategically located to prevent access from the sea, actually, to the city of Stockholm. That lost its strategic value as soon as a technology development happened. That was the rifling of the gun that actually render this whole protection and this defense obsolete. Today, we're in a similar situation where too often our defenses are rendered obsolete due to the very fast cyber developments that we are faced with. So we believe cyber is a domain where we absolutely have to collaborate, not just between companies, but also between government and industry. And so that's the topic for today's meeting. Clearly, the reason for that is that this is a man-made domain. That's the reason. We're still shaping this domain, so that requires really collaboration. The speed of technology is still there. I mean, Moore's law is still applicable. It's moving fast. Jamie already mentioned 80-90% of the critical infrastructure is actually owned by industry, so therefore it requires collaboration. The second is that we see trends that still the vulnerabilities are increasing. Our third quarter report that we did for the what's called the X-Force report of IBM showed that this year, again, we expect between 8 and 10,000 vulnerabilities to be disclosed, which is pretty much a stable number compared to last year, but we see that the severity and the complexity of these things is increasing, especially things like ransomware. And now, by the way, we see things like ransomware as a service or infection as a service being deployed by hackers around the world. Last but not least, another reason why this is a collaborative domain, we see new trends, the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is really merging the physical and the digital world and bringing that together. That means that a lot more systems are coming online. A large number of, let's say, simple devices and applications will come online, and we believe that that will raise unique vulnerabilities towards cyber and electronic warfare due to the weak security. So we believe this is a domain that really requires collaboration. You could say, okay, well, in that case, we're going to mandate. You have to share. You have to disclose your, for example, your breaches. We don't believe that's an effective model, simply because if you mandate that, it will become slow. We believe it will be legally bound in that case. Classified information will be shared. That's not the way how we see collaboration between industry and government happening. So we really want to push and see that models of voluntary information sharing and collaboration are really important. What we've seen is that sector-by-sector collaboration works best at this point in time. So the financial sector, for example, getting together with a group of trusted individuals, sharing information and intelligence about what's happening on their networks. That's happening in a pre-competitive environment because everybody has the same common objective. We're trying to protect against, let's say, hackers or against threats. It's always a trusted group of people. That's, I think, a very important notion as well. You need to find some sort of level of trust in there. Because the way you deal with the information, the provenance of the information, the accuracy of the information needs to be tested as well. IBM signed a sharing agreement with NATO, actually, about now 2 years ago, before the NICP actually came to life. And earlier this year, we launched what we call the X-Force Exchange, which is a sharing platform for our customers to join and see what's happening on IBM's network, what's happening on our customers' network. So we're looking at, let's say, 13 billion events per day, and we're extracting intelligence from that. So we believe voluntary sharing and collaboration is effective, but it's not easy to achieve. And that is a reason, simply because we have to find a sustainable and let's say, enduring model for the exchange. And information sharing and collaboration is a two-way street. Sometimes between government and industry, that is a problem. We see it sometimes too much as being a one-way street. So what do we see areas where we would like to see improvement or further developments? First of all, we got to work on risk-based management approaches. We can't protect everything. There's so much out there. How do we determine what really needs to be protected? And how do we build resiliency into our system? So if they get in, how do we bounce back, so to say? That's the first point I wanted to make here. Second, we talked about shared investment models and business cases. We do believe it is really important to develop a common approach towards developing business cases here. Let me share you some statistics here. The Poneman Institute released a report recently about a 2015 cost of data breach study. That study highlighted that the average breach will cost you $3.8 million. Which is up 23% from 2013. The average cost per record breached is $154. If you're in healthcare, it's more than double that amount. If you look at, it takes 234 days to discover a breach and 83 to plug it. So we see long duration and big impacts. Factor that into your business case. Third point, acquisition reform. Because at the end of the day, if governments need to buy stuff, the acquisition of that technology currently takes way too long. The technology developments far outpace the acquisition approach. We need, obviously, to share sharing mechanisms and so on. And last but not least, let's not forget the human factor in this one here. Jamie already mentioned that. You got to develop, a culture of discipline and hygiene around cyber. Second, focus on education and training. And third, joint participation in exercises. Get the industry to participate actively in your exercises. So we believe there's a strong call for continued and more extensive collaboration between government and industry. And let's the story of Vaxholm be an inspiration for us, because after it lost its strategic value, Vaxholm became a prison, and today it's a museum. We don't want to go down that route.
Thank you very much for that, Lindert. We'll come back to private-public partnerships in a little while. But right now, let's go to Rear Admiral Barbara Lopez, who is Director of the for Communications and Information Systems at the EUMS. Admiral.
Good evening to everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here and to see some familiar faces among the public. Digitalization, and in particular the wide adoption of internet technology, has had an incredible and irreversible impact on our lives. The last 20 years has changed how we shop, socialize, consume entertainment, and interact with governments at national and local level. So much so that the way we did things 20 years ago are unrecognizable now and counterintuitive to those under 30 years old. In my own specialization, the way we communicate in civilian life and in the military has developed to the point where today we can do things we did not dream of when I joined the Navy. Who would have imagined that this would allow me to receive a dinner invitation, check the restraint menu, work out how to get there, and video call my host to tell them I'll be late and that I'd be able to do this for 2 or 3 days without charging the battery. It was certainly not what a young naval officer thought he'd be taking for granted before he retired. But enormous opportunities for the honest, law-abiding citizens are also opportunities for the less honest. Cyberspace is now the source of a rapidly growing and adapting threat to all users of internet technology. The EU has recognized this and in 2013 launched the EU cybersecurity strategy with the aim of ensuring an open and secure cyberspace. One of many actions called for in the strategy was improved information sharing between member states and increased public-private cooperation. Incidentally, the strategy also sought to ensure dialogue with international partners, specifically including NATO. From a military perspective, the European External Action Service produced the EU Cyber Defense Policy Framework that builds on the strategy from a common security and defense perspective. This is an important document for us, as it makes clear that cyber defense is not only a question of network protection, but it is almost a philosophy or a state of mind. Such has been the pervasive adoption of internet technology, the cyber threat is now a consideration for almost everything we do, not just for communications. And the line between civilian and military, if it exists in cyberspace, is blurred. So, as we attempt to alter the way the military does business by mainstreaming cyber thinking into everything we do, a similar process is underway in the civilian world. The EU digital single market responds to the enormous social and economic changes being brought about by digitalization. It aims to create a level playing field for all players, regardless of size or country of origin. It is not about creating Fortress Europe. It is now impossible to speak of the digital economy as something quantifiable, different to the mainstream economy. The Commission recognizes this presents many opportunities and challenges, so seeks to ensure digitalization of our economy and society is beneficial for EU consumers and industry. So, why I am talking about the digital single market? Well, the military is a consumer of digital technology and services. We use the same internet equipment, techniques, and processes as industry and the private sector. Development in military technology comes from innovation in private companies. The EU and NATO have many shared values and aims in cyber defense. At a strategic level, the EU and NATO believe that the internet should be open and free, and both advocate a multi-stakeholder governance model. Both organizations see the internet as a driver for economic growth. The economic and technological benefits of the internet will be realized in the private sector and are then transferred to the public sector through effective public-private partnership. And they include academia as a particularly important component of the private sector. So I believe that the internet and digital technologies will continue to revolutionize the military, civic, industrial, and commercial communities. The EU's digital single market aims to create a level playing field and to foster growth and innovation. Continued growth in the digital economy will, I believe, with careful public-private partnership, benefit the EU's and NATO's cyber defense capabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, everyone. Let me give you these back. Thank you very much indeed to all of our introductory speakers. I'm going to throw the debate open. I would encourage people to put up their hand and put a question or a comment, either generally or to individual speakers. But before that, I would like to share some of my own skepticism and prejudices. It's always so nice in Brussels to hear everybody talking about cooperation. And everybody's been talking about cooperation, but nobody has actually, so far, identified particular areas and named particular countries or companies. And I think it really would be useful in this cyber debate if we started to talk about identifiable facts. For instance, is NATO planning to organize, or the European Union, or them together, heaven forbid, planning to organize some sort of treaty arrangements? There are press reports that the United States and China have got some sort of a cyber pact that is being looked at. Well, what's that about? And how does that work with one NATO member, a leading one, apparently wanting to strike a bilateral deal? Well, what are the politics of that? We should talk about that. I'd also like to say we're looking at a new Cold War ever since the Ukraine crisis went critical. And we've seen combat aircraft flying desperately around the Baltic. Have we seen any sort of cyber features to the heightening of, shall we say, East-West tensions? And when we talk about public-private partnerships, Lyndard, that usually is about money, not about a willingness to cooperate. So what sort of money are we looking at? Are we looking at money coming from governments, from the public purse of different governments to private sector companies? Or is it the other way around? Are the governments trying to put the arm on private sector companies to fund cyber defense? So those are some of the issues that if possible, I'd like to come back to. But first of all, could I get an idea of who would like to come in with a question or a comment? Brooks Tigner. You never fail me, Brooks. Thank you.
And he never will either.
I always have questions. I have two questions, one for Jamie and one for Mr. Bokhoven. I'm not surprised that industry doesn't want to share on a mandatory basis. It never wants to share information on a compulsive basis. Example, the Commission fought for years to get the telecom industry to share its breach data with each other and with regulators. They refused. Result, regulation. And now they have to do it. And they have to share that information with LEAs, with law enforcement agencies, and with regulators in order to fight cyber threats. So I don't see why an industry such as IBM should be exempt from that if it's necessary. Maybe you could respond to that. And to Jamie, let's turn the question exactly around. If a cyber service company was to provide completely honest information about the number of its vulnerabilities and breaches, etc., in the name of honesty, being very, very brutally honest, would NATO say, oh, that's really great, I want to work with that company? Or would they say, oh, they have so many breaches, I'm going to switch over to Symantec or someone else? Thank you.
And you first.
Yeah, no, so from my perspective, mandatory sharing is almost like the tax authorities. If I share with the tax authority, I have to share my income with them, and they actually share with me how much I have to pay for them. So it is really a burden to the whole industry. And actually it will slow down the whole process of sharing information in cyber. So from our perspective...
That's exactly what the telecom companies say.
Yeah. And we are still of that same opinion that we say, I mean, if you're going to mandate this, then what do you want to know? I mean, how much do you want to know? I mean, you get all kind of legal caveats around it. So that will create a huge system on top of, in fact, a tax system on top of companies, which, frankly speaking, we think we can better address that through voluntary mechanisms where we actually get together on a sector-by-sector model and sharing that information within the group. We think it's, in terms of combating cyber threats, we think it's much better to be proactive, sitting it together in that environment and sharing it on a voluntary basis than that the government would come back and say, I'm going to mandate that and put it as a burden on you, in fact. So, I mean, that's still the opinion on our side.
Jamie.
Thanks for the questions. Just a couple of observations. First of all, NATO itself, of course, is not negotiating international treaties, as you know on cyber space. There's action in the UN with the International Group of Government Experts, of course. There's action in the OSCE. There's various processes, London, as you know, Budapest, the Seoul, etc., The Hague, to carry this dialogue forward. I think that the bilateral arrangements like US and China are interesting. What we see at the moment is that the Chinese president has made a statement saying that China would accept to prosecute companies that are found to be involved in hacking. That's a big statement. It'd be interesting to see if it's followed up by specific action. Secondly, there's a sort of an idea that certain things in peacetime would be declared off limits hostile cyber activity, hospitals, critical infrastructure, power lines, and so on. And what the United States would like, if it could get it, would be a kind of commitment from China that it would engage in normal espionage, because that's what governments do, but would refrain from state-level attacks on industry with the aim of transferring the data to one's own industry to give it a commercial advantage. I'm not expecting that the United States would be fully satisfied, but to at least get some commitments from China on transparency and confidence building would be a start. However, because there's always a however, the counterpart of that is that China has recently introduced new legislation which would oblige American companies wanting to register and trade in the Chinese market to reveal more about their intellectual property, their technology, even their source codes to government authorities in order to be certified. And that therefore, of course, that would put them at a competitive disadvantage. So there's good news, but there's bad news as well. But I do agree that this kind of sort of political agreement bilaterally is the way to go. But, of course, there are, Brooks and Charles, you know, some useful existing international frameworks like the Budapest Convention to combat cybercrime, which commits governments to investigate, to cooperate, to exchange data, to freeze data. If we could sort of take that from the cybercrime area to the cyber defense area, it would help. The idea of cyber conflict. I think, yes, all conflicts in future are going to have a cyber dimension. Will the cyber crisis trigger the actual crisis? Will the actual crisis trigger the cyber activity? I think that's something that we need to explore. But from the military point of view, as NATO now conducts big exercises like Trident Juncture coming up in Spain, Portugal and Italy in the next couple of weeks as part of our readiness action plan, we are going to have to introduce much more realistic cyber scenarios. I mean, I was at a NATO headquarters a few years ago, speaking to a general who should not be named, and I asked him about the cyber play in the upcoming NATO exercise. He said, Jamie, I've got to tell you something. If we did cyber, the exercise would be completely shut down, so we can't do it. Well, yes. But, of course, we have to recognise that cyber will be active, and therefore, even if it means that we have to operate in a depleted cyber environment, rather like your car with two wheels running and two wheels not running, that is the name of the game. For example, I learned just a couple of days ago that the US Marine Corps is now training with a total cyber shutdown. In other words, going back to runners and pigeons and pneumatic sort of tubes, you know, on the assumption that they have to keep going where they would suffer a devastating cyber attack until the systems can be up and running and restored and bandwidth can be brought in. So we need to take that into account. There have been lots of examples where cyber has been deployed as a weapon of war. Russia's activities in Ukraine, Crimea, Israel, shutting down the Syrian Air Force, air defense system before, you remember, bombing the Korean-built reactor a few years ago. We know that over 100 countries in the world are looking at expanding cyber capabilities. We know that a number of them have offensive capabilities. So we have to be able to take that into account and prepare for it. Sorry to speak so long, but the final point that was made by Brooks... the malware sharing platform, Brooks, is designed precisely to allow people to exchange information, rather like an anonymous telephone call to the police that gives the police the information they need to act against a bank robbery, but doesn't reveal the name of the source who might be a part of that gang for all we know. So you need to sort of break things down that way. But the advantage for industry, final point, is that out of this NSIP will come a trusted industry certification process. Those industries that we work with, and we know that they take cyber defense seriously, we know that they correspond to the most demanding standards, we know they take the supply chain of where they're getting their products from seriously, those will get a kind of certificate, as is happening in the United States or the United Kingdom, that they are trustworthy partners. And, of course, those people will then get the bulk of the contracts in future precisely because they've gone through that certification process.
Thank you, Jamie. Admiral, very, very quickly, I just want to go back to the United States-China thing. Apparently, NATO is perfectly comfortable with it. How does Brussels see Beijing-Washington arrangements?
Well, thank you. This is a very difficult question to me because I am not really involved in this kind of issues. But regarding the issue we are talking about here, I think that it would be good to have here a reflection of what EU is regarding to compared to NATO a little bit, because I think that EU, as you well know, is not more than 28 countries with a treaty which is not aimed to self-defense as it is in NATO. So this is more a political treaty, which is still at the very beginning. So we have advanced in economic issues, but not in the political field, and in consequence, in the same way in the military field. So our EU's ambition in the military way is just to, well, it's to be a security provider, but it's not to cope with full scale conflicts as it is in NATO. And regarding to cyber, in fact, we are aligned with NATO's feelings and industry, what has been said here. We are completely aligned, but to us, the cyber is it touches very fast the sovereignty of the different member states, and this is a very delicate issue. So, where is the limit? The EU is just pushing to defend their own networks and to be resilient to the attacks, but for example, the to be offensive in these networks is not yet thought. I mean, it's not in our it's not in the EU's intention to go further in this field. So we think that exactly that the cooperation and the partnership with industry is the main pillar, not only with partnership but with the industry, but also with the public, all sectors of public, which is any agency within the states. But we have to be very very careful with the sovereignty issue.
Thank you very much indeed. Right, from one admiral to another, admiral, and I'll round up and take a few. Yeah.
Thank you, Brigadier General Joe Kuhlman from the Ekman Institute. Thank you, General, for putting the issue of public-private partnership so central in the announcement and also during our discussion here. Now, in think tanks, the role is to advise, to warn, and to stimulate. But tonight, I want to warn about considering public-private partnership as the relationship exactly in this area of cyber. And my advice was not to stimulate that and to leave even out that world. I think, let's say, cyber, certainly at a strategic level, it's a responsibility, as you mentioned, from Washington, from Peking, from our national headquarters, and also for the European Union, where they have supranational authorities. And the relationship between those and the companies, to my understanding, should be a relationship between the customer and the provider. As you mentioned, Jamie, it's like buying an aircraft. It's the country that gives the specifications. And then on a more tactical level, you get into dialogue to make sure that it is. But I think that the rules of the road have to be established not in partnership, but by the authorities, by our countries. And if I see the difficulties we have at the moment, at the European Union, at the level of the Commission, and at the level of our individual nations, with the Googles and the Facebooks of this world, I don't like the word partnership, because that would be give a little, take a little. No way. Absolutely no way. Because if not, we will have to go like China and develop our own Google. If China can do it, we can do it. So the relationship should not be one of a partnership. So I will not cite Winston Churchill, but I would cite another Prime Minister of the United Kingdom about public-private relationship as the relationship, simply by saying, no, no, no.
Thank you very much for that. Yes, let's go here.
Yeah, two questions which are the same from two different angles. When you say about scenarios, I mean, you keep talking about scenarios where, in terms of civil defense, you're talking about China, you're talking about countries. But at the end, I would like to hear to what extent the scenario is the cyber guerrilla, cyber terrorism, cyber war by proxy, meaning, I don't know, African small states, which at the end would be, I mean, the origin of cyber attacks. And in that angle, or from that perspective, I mean, what is the enemy in a way? We're talking cyber defense. There's no cyber defense without an enemy. So who is the enemy in your perspective? Let's put that clear. And related to that, where is the border between cyber defense, understood as a military thing, which is what we're discussing here, and cyber police? Because at the end, in the normal defense environment, that's pretty clear. Well, not totally clear, less and less clear. You know that better than I do. But it is more or less clear. In the cyber environment, I don't exactly see where do you put the border about an attack to an infrastructure where the police is preventing and an attack to infrastructure where the NATO is preventing. Where do you put the border there?
Jamie, who's the enemy?
These are all good points and good questions. First of all, Joe, I'll come to you in a moment, but to the first set of questions, it's obviously the case that cyber has introduced a sort of element of anarchy into international security. You know, the focus of security policy is to organise and put order, transparency, predictability, confidence, red lines, rules into the game. And cyber has sort of blown all of that up, hopefully not permanently for the time being. It eliminates borders. You can be attacked from anywhere, anytime. The Internet of Things is going to produce 1 trillion points of vulnerability in the international system. Each new technology, cloud, virtualization, artificial intelligence brings with it new vulnerabilities as well. And again, remember that at the moment about one-third of humanity are online. And gradually, that one-third of humanity that's online is learning, you know, to deal with security, albeit risk management, because you can't cover all risks. For example, you're using a lot more care when you use your credit card on the internet these days than you would have done a few years ago. But now we're going to have another third of humanity coming online in the next 10 years, essentially from Africa. And if we don't speed up the security process, and this is nothing about Africans, it's just a lot of new people coming along, then, you know, as they connect to the World Wide Web and to the Internet of Everything, where machine is connected to machine, machine to people, people to people, then they're going to sort of, you know, introduce a lot of new vulnerabilities into our system as well. So the problem with cyber is that the vulnerabilities are going to stay ahead of the response for some time to come. Now, the big problem here is that anybody can play. You don't need a major program, you don't need a lot of money, you don't need to go through a 10-year sort of education program like you need to fly one of the aircraft in the past. And so there is a massive number of, you know, mercenaries out there. A lot of cyber attacks are organized by criminal networks. They carry that out on behalf of the state in return for protection, for example. That's particularly the case with some actors. One of the reasons at the moment why we're very much seeking to have a dialogue with the Cybercrime Center and Rob Wainwright up there in The Hague, up at Europol, is because they look at, you know, all of the criminal activities. And some of the things that we're seeing carry the same trademark, the same DNA that he and his people are seeing in the criminal world. So the more we can learn about the criminal side, the more we can identify the actors and the individuals who can be used by a state to carry out an attack in the future as well. And of course, with a largely computer literate population now, we've got almost an infinite supply of potential hackers in the future. Indeed, we need to increasingly recruit hackers who know the milieu as our best line of defence. The UK, even a couple of years ago, the Ministry of Defence introduced a new policy where it gave hackers a kind of pardon, a religious pardon, the absolution of sins, if they promised, no, not to hack any longer and use all of their dark magic and know-how to defend government networks indeed. So this is an area where the division between the good guys and the bad guys has turned out to be the grey guys, and we need to learn how to manage that in the future. What is the difference between cyber police and cyber defence? Well, obviously a cyber attack is something that's done for political reasons. It's not done to make money. It's done to gain a political strategic advantage, intimidating an opponent, constraining his behaviour, learning intelligence about him, which could be used to prepare an attack in the future. Whereas the cybercrime doesn't care if it's a bank or an insurance company or if it's you, me, totally neutral when it comes to the target, as long as there is money to be made or data to be stolen that can be used for commercial purposes. That's what I would say would be the distinction between cyber attack and cyber police. Joe, good point. I think you're right. I think at the end of the day, we cannot sort of leave it to the private sector to protect us. And I think that as long as the private sector is left by itself, as you can see at the moment, it will try to come up with products which are, of course, for the benefit of the consumer, which is faster, more connected, more apps, you know, giving people more choice than they possibly need, and more encryption to protect their privacy. And as you know, in the wake of the Snowden affair, one of the big issues at the moment between governments and the private sector, Google and Apple and others, is as they increasingly go for extremely sophisticated encryption on their systems, governments no longer have those back doors or their ability to sort of look at those systems to track terrorists. So we now have, of course, a direct contradiction for the first time in a long time between the demands of the private sector vis-a-vis consumers and what governments feel they have to have, not to spy on all of their citizens, as the Andrew Parker, the head of MI5, said in an interview in London this week, but to be able to go after the guys who are trying to harm us. So I agree. I think there is a relationship to be had, but governments at the end of the day have to be in the driving seat of what it is that they particularly want. You know, again, knowing what type of product you need, rather than obviously, you know, just what is the sexiest thing out there, is probably a good place to start.
So, Jamie, finding a forum in which the big private sector market players can discuss with governments, is that a NATO thing, or is that a EU, or what?
I'm sorry to talk so much. Sort of just say a few brief things and let the others come in. But I think everybody's going to have their sort of industry partnership. The EU will have its, and it has the NIST directive, of course, although there is certain elements there we know, which is the reason why it's been slowed down. It's still being debated by the Council and the Parliament. But it will have it. So governments will have theirs. There is also industry to industry. I mean, there are industry, sector to sector, as Lennart rightly said, where the banking community has its own element. The critical infrastructure community has its own element. The air traffic control community has its own element. The question is to what degree how we try to sort of join these various networks up. But of course, it's also the case in all of these things that trust often works better with a small group of people than with a much larger group of people. And so there's the balance always between comprehensiveness, I've got all of the actors, but at the same time keeping it sufficiently confidential that people feel that they can trust each other sharing sensitive data without it leaking out.
So let's ask the Admiral and Lennart, is this a recipe for chaos that Jamie has just described? All these different little groups making up their own different sets of rules. Sounds like a recipe for chaos to me. And it contrasts rather with the centralized approach, presumably, that the Chinese government is able to take.
Well, this is a difficult question. I would like to try to respond to your question because it's a very good one about the borders of the cyber defense. So, and I would try to give you the EU perspective on this. In the EU, each member state is responsible for their own cyber defense and cyber security. So that means that, for example, in Spain, this cyber defense is divided in different. The cyber security is shared between different agencies. There are a specific defense for the governmental ones. There are a specific defense for the defense networks. And the industry has their own defense mechanisms. So the only one who's allowed by law to respond actively to a cyber attack is the cyber command. So the defense. But this is an example. The other member states are organized, is a sovereign issue, so each one has its own organization. In the EU, we have each, because the EU, the problem is that it seems that the EU is one thing, but there are many institutions here. Each own has its own networks, so it's not an easy issue because there are islands, there are things, but generally speaking, we have the CERT-EU. The CERT-EU is responsible to gather intel information about and to provide intel information, cyber information, to the centers of defense of the networks. And other part of the EU, of course, are the CSDP missions and operations. So there are what we call the EU operations, wider network, which is defended by the U.S. As well, is defended by here. There is a division responsible for that. And then down, this is at the strategic level, but down in the operational tactical level, we rely on member states which are providing means and capabilities to the mission. So this is the main scheme for that.
Admiral, thank you. I'm sorry to ask you a question and then hurry you through the answer. Lend it quickly. Recipe for chaos.
Personally, I don't think so. I think it would be absolutely a recipe for disaster if we would try to bring everything under one roof. I think that will simply never work. I mean, that will put free enterprise, so to say, directly at odds with regulations and things like that. But of course, we're on
which is sometimes the case, of course.
Of course it is. But I mean, we don't think that that's going to be the good all end all solution to this issue here. Leave it up to the industry where they can solve the problem by themselves. But of course, we're touching on a very important topic like security versus privacy. And that always is, you know, got to strike a balance there. But I mean, that's to a certain extent not part of the discussion here, but it definitely is always a topic that comes up. I mean, how far do you go with your rules and regulations? I don't think it is a recipe for disaster if you would leave it up to the industry to sort out these issues themselves.
Okay. I'm very struck by the findings of a recent poll that showed that 4/5 of us don't trust the internet and 3/4 of us are not prepared to give any more information to companies operating the internet. You wanted to come in. Yes, please. And if I can ask you to make it short and sharp, because we're running over time.
Yes, good evening. Just a small, short question. An issue that we have been discussing in the EU, which is in the larger context of a partnership, I would like to, which is responsible disclosure, and it's. I would like to know the view of NATO as a military alliance on that, and of a big multinational company on this issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. The key thing is because the private sector owns and operates the networks on which our traffic flows, they often see things earlier. Up front, you know, on the network before it reaches us. And so the early warning aspect, I think, is very important in terms of the private sector as well. Now, the other thing, of course, is when it comes to investigations, what we call forensics, you know, freezing data so that you can analyse it later and, if necessary, use it as evidence. Again, you know, we need the cooperation of the internet service providers critically in that respect to sort of take responsibility for the data that they are conveying and not simply say that they are a road on which it's flowing and that it's only, if you like, the car which is responsible, not the road itself. So I think there, you know, Lendert referred to this, there is still a dialogue, and this comes to the essence of Joe's question to be had, who is liable for what? When there is a cyber attack, you know, am I liable because I didn't take enough of a personal protection? Is industry liable because they sold me a lousy software in the first place, which was full of bugs, and they should have done better and didn't rectify it? So I think we need a debate, not just on better management, but also to identify clearly, you know, who is responsible for what part of the cybersecurity chain, and ultimately, therefore, who is liable or responsible when things go wrong. As you know, the internet was never designed with security in mind. And as Eric Schmidt, you know, the CEO of Google, famously says, the internet is the first thing that man has ever invented, which he doesn't understand. Well, we need to dialogue with industry, first of all, to really understand what the internet is. And then we can obviously factor in security. But Giles, I understand that, you know, we've seen the dark side of the internet. It's true. But there is no going back to the pre-internet age, as much as you and I might potentially like that. There is not. And, of course, you know, when it comes to growth in the European Union, I mean, colleague here knows this better than I, you know, the economic boon, as well as in the developing world, from a free and open internet is absolutely massive. So we don't want to sort of kill the chicken or the hen that lays the golden an X, but we just obviously want to sort of introduce a certain element of order and trust into this in order to reap those benefits.
Thanks.
Just one short comment. This is exactly the reason why, from an industry perspective, we feel responsible for sharing security intelligence with other organizations and with governments and so on as well, in order to allow that free enterprise to run on that, on these infrastructures as well. So sharing cyber intelligence for us, critical thing.
Thank you very much. I'm going to bring the discussion to a close with just one thought, I think. First of all, I expect that most of us came here today with the feeling that we know that it's still a huge, amorphous, complicated problem, but it's useful to try and get a sort of snapshot whenever we can of where things are moving. And it seems to me, yes, we're getting a bit of a snapshot here, that structures are being put in place, cooperative arrangements are being planned, perhaps taking shape. My own reaction, I don't know how common this might be, is that I think we're getting to a stage where we need to start making distinctions. Jamie was talking about Europol, Rob Wainwright up there. I think we need to start distinguishing between money-based vulnerabilities and security-based vulnerabilities. And I also think we need to start distinguishing between effective national defenses and essential supranational defenses. And I think at the moment that's rather a blurred picture. So it does strike me that the more we defend, we produce our defences, the higher the rate of vulnerabilities and attacks seems to rise, which doesn't suggest that the defences are being so far very effective. So my feeling is that in all the work that's going on at the moment, it would be helpful if we had some clearer snapshots of what we're actually talking about in different areas. And I'm really pleased that we touched on this really thorny problem of how, in market economies, do you persuade companies to, in effect, give up some of their competitive advantage for the greater good. How do we ensure that the competition authorities aren't the sort of tail that wags the cybersecurity dog? With which thought, may I thank our three speakers very much indeed, but also the North Rhine-Westphalia office here for so kindly hosting us. Thank you very much for coming here today.